You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, chaps. We're not actually together, are we? We're doing this remotely again. And we're going to talk about the Olympics. Lionel, I think you've got a news roundup for us.
Well, yeah, before we get to the Olympics, it's been a while since we podcasted, hasn't it? Since the Tour de France, a couple of weeks at least have gone.
We got together last week briefly for a little discussion of the Lizzie Armistead story, which was in our cycling podcast, Femina, which was released last week. But this is our first regular podcast since the Tour de France.
It is indeed. God, I'd almost forgotten that. But yeah, well, you're right. We did do that. Yeah, so a couple of weeks of news to catch up on. I'll keep it to the sort of main headlines. Lots of racing going on since the Tour de France. Simon Yates won his first race since coming back from suspension. The Prueba Villafranca one-day race in Spain. That was at the end of July. Dries De Venins won the Tour of Wallonie in Belgium. Michael Valgren won the Tour of Denmark. The first big World Tour race since the Tour, the San Sebastian Classic, was won by Bauke Mollema of Trek, carrying his Tour form into that race in the Basque Country. Tom Boonen won the Ride London, quite an interesting event-packed race that was. It was stopped for about 25 minutes because there had been crashes in the Sportive event which preceded it, and the peloton had to stop in the road and wait until a blockage in the road further up the course was cleared. Then TV viewers lost pictures of Geraint Thomas when he seemingly was on his way to victory. And then we saw just the sprint finish in the Mall. Tom Boonen of Belgium winning that. Richard was at the Tour of Utah where Lachlan Morton won. And Alberto Contador picking his form back up after crashing at the Tour de France and pulling out of the Tour. He won the Vuelta a Burgos. The women's Ride London race was won by Kirsten Wild of the Netherlands. A bit of transfer news, confirmed transfers these are. Nicholas Roach is leaving Sky and joining BMC Racing, as I think we said during the Tour de France on the podcast. Roman Kreuziger's going from the Tinkoff team, which is folding. He's joining Orica Bike Exchange. John Degenkolb is moving from Giant to Trek. Peter Sagan's move to Bora Hansgrohe has been confirmed. And Moreno Moser is leaving Cannondale and joining Astana. The 2012 Giro champion Ryder Heyerdahl is retiring at the end of the season. The Bahrain Merida team has been confirmed, which seems to be a bit of a hybrid of the Lamprey team and money coming in from the Bahraini royal family. And finally, the 2017 World Tour is being expanded. I think they've added 10 more races, including the Tour of Qatar, Het Nieuwsblad, Strada Bianca, and the Tour of California and Ride London. It's now 37 races and a whopping 177 days of racing. We'll no doubt talk about this probably during the off-season, about whether this is a good or bad thing for the World Tour, but it now seems to be pretty much every race is in the World Tour, a great unwieldy, bloated calendar of events. But like I say, we'll discuss that at some point. Obviously, the whole world's attention is currently on the Olympics, so I suppose we ought to talk about the road races first, Rich.
Yeah, absolutely. You did mention that I was at the Tour of Utah. I'm just back from the Tour of Utah, slightly jet-lagged, but I will be, you will hear a package from there later on that'll sort of form the second half of the podcast. It includes an interview with Lachlan Morton, who, as you said, won the race and just showed what a talent he is. 24 years old, has ridden at the World Tour level before, didn't work out for him, and, you know, one of the questions I put to him was whether he would be looking for a ride back at that level. So we'll see, but it was a fascinating trip, and as I said, you'll hear about that later on in the podcast. You didn't mention actually that Frank Schleck is also retiring at the end of the year, Lionel.
I didn't know. I forgot Frank Schleck was still a professional cyclist. A joke, of course.
Someone very cruelly, I can't remember, it was a French account, someone very cruelly posted on Twitter that Frank Schleck had announced he was retiring at the end of the year. His career retired 2 years ago.
That's very unkind, isn't it? And his brother, Andy Schleck, had a fire in his bike shop.
Oh, really? Frank actually rode a very good Tour de France.
He did, to be fair. He did. Anyway, we're going to start with the road races, aren't we? We've just watched the time trials at the Olympic Games, and the road races, though, served up some thrills and spills, I guess. Talk about the men's road race first, which was won on Saturday by Greg Van Avermaet. Now, all the talk has been of how hard this road race was going to be and how it would be. You know, we were talking of it as being similar to the road world championships in maybe in Colombia in 95 or Solange in 1980. It was being talked about in the same category of being really selective, a course that would suit a real climbing specialist. Nobody would have predicted Greg Van Avermaet as the winner.
No, and one of the points that's been made since the race is that perhaps if Peter Sagan had had a crystal ball and had seen that Van Avermaet was going to win, then he would have lined up for the road race instead of the mountain bike race, which is, you know, quite a long shot for him, I would imagine, although, you know, it's very difficult to say because we don't know what his mountain biking prowess is going to be like. But it was a kind of super classic course, really, rather than a mountain stage of a Grand Tour type test. And there was obviously a lot of climbing, but it wasn't one that, you know, it wasn't going so super high or you know, super long climbs. I think the main climb was about 18-19 minutes, which is significant for a one-day race, but it didn't turn out to be the sort of showdown between all of the Grand Tour overall type riders. In fact, it was the perfect one-day test because it gave them a chance, but it also gave classics riders like Greg Van Avermaet a chance.
I think there's always a problem with evaluating, judging courses with any kind of circuit, and it wasn't a pure circuit race, but we see year after year at the World Championships the team managers, national coaches go and look at the course, or riders go and look at the course a year in advance, and they come back and they give their verdict. They say, oh, this is for climbers, this is for classics riders, and very often they're wrong, and that's partly to do with the, you know, unusual dynamics of a what is usually a circuit race. So there is that factor, but I also think that this brings into focus the fact that all that tells professional riders and the pro peloton that a particular race is going to pan out the way they think it's going to pan out is effectively the history of a race and the fact that, for example, the Tour of Lombardy, everyone knows that it is really for good climbers. And I think, you know, if you gave someone that actual route or gave someone the profile or sent someone to recce the route, they wouldn't necessarily come to that conclusion. I think that was the case with the Rio course. The fact that there's no history when you go to a World Championship or an Olympic Games is what really confuses people, and they haven't got the precedent of 80 previous editions to know what kind of ride is going to be good.
And actually throws it open. You know, it was a very open race. Partly that was because of the crashes. I mean, I suppose the big question is, Vincenzo Nibali was the kind of big favourite, and he got away on the final time up the climb, and with Sergio Henao and Rafał Majka, the three of them were away. You know, had they stayed away, they would have each got a medal, but Nibali was really drilling it on the downhill. We didn't see the crash because the motorbike couldn't keep up with him. He seemed quite a cautious motorcycle pilot, I have to say. He lost the wheel of Vincenzo Nibali, and Majka lost the wheel a little bit as well, and that probably saved his race because he was able to get around Henao and Nibali when they came off, and they both fell into a gutter that was very dangerous. But, you know, Richie Porte also came off earlier in the race, and he has said today that it's not the course that's dangerous, it's the riders that make it dangerous. And that was quite a controversial thing to say after Sunday's race. We'll talk after Sunday's women's race, which we'll talk about in a moment or two. But Nibali, you know, we don't really know because we haven't seen the crash, but was he to blame? Perhaps it seemed that he was trying to get away from his two companions to not leave it for a sprint. But, you know, as was pointed out in the commentary, the three of them were, had they stayed away, would have got a medal each.
Well, they would have done, and Nibali came off worse in that crash. I think the early reports were that he'd fractured both collarbones, so it was a heavy fall. And really, we know all about Nibali's descending. You know, that it does give him an edge over a lot of riders. But I wonder whether that was the smartest move, because if he'd gone to the line with Sergio Henao, you'd have to think that Nibali would beat Henao in a sprint. Majka maybe a little bit more of a danger, but did he really need to push it and get away on the descent? Or there was still quite a lot of road to go from the bottom of that descent, as we saw in the women's race And well, we saw in the men's race as well, as Van Avermaet hauled in Rafał Majka in, you know, that interminable long straight. I mean, it was sort of, well, it was, what was it, 7 kilometres from the bottom of the climb, and it was, you know, really straight for at least the last two or so. And you could see, you know, the riders chasing could see their target a long way up ahead. So it was a strange one for Nibali to take risks. But I suppose at the sharp end of an Olympic road race or any kind of race where the prize is that high, and there is a psychological thing as well. It's not like the World Championships where there's another one next year. There's only one chance every 4 years to win this. So you can't really blame the riders for putting everything on the line. But certainly, having seen the damage that the crash to Richie Porte had done the preceding lap, it was not a descent to push and take risks on, particularly with that very high curb. I mean, that was what caused a lot of the damage, wasn't it?
And they'd been down it before, those guys. You know, Richie Porte, no, but those guys had been down it before. They'd all been down it before in training as well. They knew what it was like. It's a curious one. I mean, I watched the race, most of the race, again yesterday. I saw just bits of it on Saturday. It was fascinating to watch Van Avermaet and how active he was earlier in the race. I mean, he attacked with 70 kilometres to go. I think he was helped a lot when the Italians sort of arrived in force in that front group and really drove that group, and everybody else had a bit of a free ride at that point. But he rode outstandingly well. I think the other guy worth mentioning, Jakob Fuglsang, made the move that really that closed the gap to Majka, because it did look at one point as though he might stay away. And the other guy worth mentioning is Julian Alaphilippe, who rode an excellent race and finished fourth. He apparently crashed as well on the final descent, but got back up and, you know, had ridden, he had sort of started that final climb not in the front group but with Chris Froome and others, and rode past Froome and everybody else up to the group, finished fourth, and not far off winning it, I don't think.
Yeah, just going back to Nibali is renowned as a brilliant descender, but I suppose there are two definitions of a brilliant descender. One is one who never crashes, and the other one is a rider that goes very fast downhill, and Nibali is certainly the latter. I mean, he is a risky descender, and there have been various occasions over the years when he has crashed taking risks. And just on Van Avermaet, Rich, I mean, it's kind of interesting. You know, you talked about what a great race he's ridden, but he's ridden a lot of great races in the last few months, and he's really got into that groove that riders sometimes find late in their career. And particularly, you know, we've seen this before with riders who have a habit, a really unwelcome habit of finishing second or third a lot, and suddenly something clicks, and suddenly they start winning, and all of the kind of desperation goes, and all of the kind of nerves go, and suddenly they become very cool-headed in race finales. And this always reminds me, when riders do this, it always reminds me of Davide Rebellin, actually, in 2004, when he got to the Ardennes, and he'd had this terrible run of finishing second, third, and obviously the caveats, usual caveats apply with Rebellin. But in that week, he just seemed to settle on this formula of just waiting, and it was something that he'd not been able to do before, and waiting and taking the right decisions and being just very clear-sighted in pressure situations. And Van Avermaet finally seems to have locked into that, and he can almost do no wrong at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a fantastic season. I think back to the start of the year when he really sort of outfoxed everybody at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. He won Tirreno Adriatico as well, which is, you know, no mean feat for a rider. I know it's not a super hilly race, but, you know, a rider of, you know, the previous background. And he probably won one of the most impressive stages of the Tour, the one in the Massif Central at Le Lyon, where he got a big gap and he took the yellow jersey and then kept the yellow jersey into the Pyrenees. And now, of course, you know, winning the Olympics, arguably the biggest victory of his career. But it's been, as you say, Daniel, a proper sort of late breakthrough year for him at 31. It was turned 31 earlier this year.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Eurosport, for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. And the action continues on the home of cycling, the Arctic Race of Norway. All 4 days of that. A race that Daniel has been at before. I remember your infamous Arctic report, Daniel.
Infamous. Wow, I'll be very interested to hear your Utah. See how that compares. Anyway, go on.
Anyway, I've got no hen parties in my Tour of Utah report, unfortunately. But coverage starts of the Arctic Race of Norway on Thursday, the 11th of August.
What just you while you mentioned the Arctic Circle there, sorry, our friend Simon Gill, our photographer, is cycling towards the Arctic Circle. Now he headed off from Tring in Hertfordshire on Saturday, and he's hoping to reach Tromsø, deep in the Norwegian Arctic, in around, well, it'd be 2.5 weeks' time now.
Yeah,
epic trip.
Been following
for charity. Check out Twitter. Simon Gill Photo is his Twitter handle.
Yeah, I've been watching, following his progress. Ride. He seemed to make a friend yesterday, I noticed, but entertaining tweets from Simon as he rides towards the Arctic Circle. So the women's road.
Not a new friend from a hen party. I hope he's a married man, Simon.
No, we've moved on from hen parties. Don't worry. Well, the women's road race on Sunday. Now, dominated really by the awful crash of Annemiek van Vleuten, the Dutch rider who had got away from Mara Abbott. Those two had escaped on the climb. Mara Abbott, a specialist climber. Van Vleuten, more of a time trialist, really. A very strong rider. And again, like the men's race, not somebody that you would have maybe picked out as a pre-race favourite. But I think she would have won the race had she not crashed. It was an awful crash. And I think that really overshadowed the race. She was sort of lying stricken on the road for a long time, and you know, we didn't know the state of her injuries as the race finished, and it really made the end of the race kind of hard to enjoy, but it was a real thriller. Abbott was away on her own, and she was caught very close to the line, really thanks to Elisa Longo-Borghini, who ended up with a bronze medal, but did a lot of work to bring Abbott back. The race was won by Anna van der Breggen, who was the Dutch teammate of Van Vleuten, and probably the pre-race favourite, I think, for a lot of people. Emma Johansson got the silver medal, and Longo-Borghini got the bronze. But it was a sickening crash, wasn't it, Lionel?
Horrible. Really horrible. Not one that I wanted to watch again. The first impression was that it was really bad because there was just no movement from Van Vleuten at all, and you did fear the worst. And you're absolutely right, Rich. It was a thrilling denouement to the race, but it was really hard to enjoy or really even concentrate on what was going on, because you were listening to the commentary and studying Twitter, hoping that there would be some positive news about the Dutch riders' injuries. And fortunately, we did get that after the finish. But really, the way the race played out, it a lot was made of the safety aspects of the course. But in terms of making exciting racing that comes down to the finish, you can't argue that they got it right, because the men's race was in the balance right to the line, and the women's race, I mean, you couldn't really script a better finish than that. Poor old Mara Abbott, I mean, it didn't work out for her, but she was exactly the right rider to be away in those circumstances, the sort of the weaker rouleur, not a rouleur at all, as you say, Rich, a specialist climber. Although it was curious that she didn't really press home that advantage on the climb as perhaps we would have expected. But she was the tortoise, and the chasing group were the hares. And you know, the heartbreaking thing for her was that she went from first to fourth in a few hundred meters and ended up empty-handed when, you know, a medal really was the least she deserved.
Yeah, Longo-Borghini, we spoke to her in the second episode of the cycling podcast Femina, when she'd been in a way and a break with Ashley Moolman and Lizzie Armistead at the women's tour, and against the instructions of her team, really, she worked hard in that group and ended up, I think, third, or you know, certainly didn't win. She's definitely a racer, and you know, in that group on Sunday, she wasn't, you know, she was just riding for the win, knowing that she might not win from that group, but there was no cat and mouse from her, no caginess at all. And I think, you know, had she not put in the digs that she did, Abbott may well have stayed away, because the other three might have the others two might have sort of looked at each other and not, you know, just held something back. It was very close in the end, but as I said, van der Breggen, a favorite before the race. Again, though, you know, Lizzie Armistead, who had talked all year about this being her big target, but being worried about how hilly it was, I think had she not had the drama, the stress of the week leading up to the race, she was fifth in the end, But you could have imagined her being in that leading group, couldn't you? Had she been in the kind of form that she's been in all year?
Well, yeah, it wasn't just the drama and the awkwardness of the three missed tests becoming public and her appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport being made public. We discussed that at length in the cycling podcast Feminan, if anyone wants to hear what we thought about that at the time. Clearly, the stress had taken its toll on Armitstead. After we'd recorded that, she then made appearances on Sky and the BBC, and she looked like somebody who wasn't really in a fit state of mind to compete in one of the most important sporting events in the world, but she managed to get it together enough to be on the start line. But the drama didn't really end there, because she had a problem with her bike, a puncture I think it was, just as they were reaching the first serious climb, and her teammate Emma Pooley was at the front lifting the pace quite significantly, stringing the bunch right out whilst Armitstead was off the back. And because there were no race radios, there was no way of Armitstead or Nikki Harris, the other British rider, communicating to Pooley that she should slow down and allow Armitstead to get back on. So it was quite a tough chase for Lizzie Armitstead, and when she got back to the bunch, she didn't really spare Nikki Harris too much. It looked like she was criticising Harris for not dropping back and helping her catch up, and so she was on the back foot really from the start of the race. And then when the serious climbs towards the end came, once the break had gone away, she certainly rode them at her own pace initially, and then timed her effort and was passing people, and then was in a group that, you know, if things had panned out just slightly differently in those the last 2k of the last climb and then the descent and the flat, if it had been just a little bit different, she might have been with a shout of a medal. But in the end, she won the sprint for fifth place, and by the looks of it, and certainly from her interview with Jill Douglas on the BBC afterwards, she looked like she was glad the whole Olympic experience was over.
Well, talk of no radios, Lionel, is an interesting one, because that, you know, the question is, was that a factor in the men's race and the women's race being so exciting? But there was also a real lack of information for the viewer as well. And it was the same, I remember, in London in 2012. You know, the Olympic Games can look a bit like a second-rate race, because it doesn't they're just, and we've seen it in the time trial as well today, just not the information really on screen that you need in order to fully sort of appreciate and understand and enjoy the racing.
Not only that, but everybody's riding in unfamiliar colors. They're not even riding in their normal world championship national colors. They have Olympic jerseys, and so it takes a little while. You know, the men's race was long, but it took a little while to work out which colours were which. And I was, struggling to pick out Great Britain against America and other teams. You know, the Dutch weren't particularly, I'm looking, who's the Dutch? They should be in orange. Oh, no, they're not. They're in blue, white and red. And so I know maybe for sort of more casual observers, that's not as much of a factor. But I think the fact that sort of cycling enthusiasts struggling on a day like this, it should be a real wake-up call for people who are running the sport to recognize that it's quite hard to follow unless you really know quite a bit about it, and you know who people are, and you recognize people from their from their body shapes or the type of helmet they're wearing or the shoes. Or you're looking for little clues, but really, as a televisual event, there has to be an awful lot more. I mean, the riders, rather than having their just their national team names on the jerseys for something like the Olympics, they need their own names prominently on their jerseys. And the on-screen graphics did leave a lot to be desired, and time gaps weren't reliable. Chris Borman was doing a manful job trying to put into context whether a time gap on the screen could or couldn't be trusted. And I think that's, again, a fairly damning indictment of the quality of the coverage. And that's not the BBC's fault. That's the host broadcasting team, which will have been put together for the Rio Olympics. It will be a bringing together of broadcasters from all around the world.
Well, it's disappointing. I mean, maybe the IOC could redirect some of the $900 a day that they give to IOC officials in expenses into some technology for the cycling, because it does have it's very kind of, it looks like a sort of a bit like a village road race or something. It's third and fourth categories road race or something. It's very odd. It's very, very odd.
But on On the other hand, I think one of the things that people enjoyed about the Olympic road race was the chaos element. But I think the main factor in that was the size of the teams, and always is the size of the teams in the Olympic road race. I mean, particularly for the teams that have only four or three riders, the sort of domestique's job is really, it can almost be redundant in some cases. It's really a bit of a lottery. You know, you can try to work for a specific goal, as, for example, Great Britain did in 2012 in London, but it really, the chips have to really fall in your favour for even the teamwork to be in any way useful. And, you know, it's raised interesting questions about what ASO in particular, and Christian Prudhomme, director of the Tour de France, are going to do in view of the Tour next year. They talked after this year's race about possibly reducing the team sizes. It's difficult for them, it might be tricky for them to do that under the rules of the World Tour, mightn't it, Rich? I think you had a bit of a discussion about this on Twitter the other day. However, I think that they're pretty determined to do that, reduce the team sizes, whether it's going to be seven or eight riders or even six riders, which I think is unlikely, and we'll have to wait and see. But I think they will ultimately try to reduce the team sizes.
Well, let's
just on that, sorry Daniel, the other dimension is that there are you're looking out for trade team allegiances as well. I mean, there was a point on the final climb when there was a group which had about three Astana riders in it, and obviously it takes a while to sort of compute that they all ride together for the majority of the year. But it's certainly the team size and the inequality between, you know, I mean, the biggest teams only had five, but you know, some of the established teams still only had three or four riders. I mean, the French only had four established riders in the race, and it certainly led to a lot of the chaos. It meant every man had to scrap for themselves, and it took out that ultra level of control that we see particularly in the Grand Tours.
And the classic example, Lionel, of trade team allegiances overriding national team allegiances was in 2000 in Sydney. The road race there was won by Jan Ulrich, second was Andreas Klöden, third was Alexander Vinokourov, all part of the same trade team. And they were all, this was not known, it was certainly not legal at the time, but they were all hooked up to the same radios. So I think they all have effectively the same director sportif.
Excellent. I think, I could be naive here, but I think there was less of that in this race. I was quite surprised at how much, say, Damiano Caruso did for Nibali. I don't think he was working for...
Sicilian alliance though, Richard. I don't know if you've seen any of the Godfather films, but you don't... Sicilians tend to stick together.
Yeah, yeah. Kwiatkowski, though, at one, you know, he'd been out all day, but he used whatever he had left to help the group. And it was Chris Boardman actually suggested that it might have been for one of his Team Sky teammates, perhaps Sergio Henao. But he also had Rafał Majka in the group as well. And I didn't really see any evidence of trade team alliances overriding national team alliances. But yeah, of course, it always goes on. Shall we turn our attention briefly to the time trials? Because we've just watched that. You mentioned Emma Pooley earlier, Lionel, and she was a controversial selection for the British team. She did appear at the front of the road race. She was there to do a job for Lizzie Armstead, but her main focus was the time trial. She's done absolutely nothing all year to suggest that she would be in medal contention, and she was only 14th, which I think was a performance that most would have predicted. So a very surprising, controversial selection for the British team. But the race was won by Kristen Armstrong, her third Olympic time trial title in a row. I think she's 42, isn't she? She's gonna turn 43 pretty soon.
43 tomorrow. And you talk about Pooley's selection being controversial, Rich, but Kristen Armstrong competes even less than Emma Pooley has this year. I mean, she's effectively parachuted in for the Olympics. Yeah, so
but a worthy winner. And for a while, it was looking like Olga Zabalinskaya was going to win, the Russian rider. She won two bronze medals in London 4 years ago. If you listen to the Tour, the cycling podcast, Feminin, where I was recapping what had happened in the 2012 Olympics, when that was recorded, Zabalinskaya was actually not going to be competing in Rio because she was one of the Russian athletes who was facing a ban. And because she had been suspended for 18 months after failing a dope test in 2014, it didn't look like she was going to be able to argue her way back in. But there she was on the start line for the road race, and a silver medalist, very nearly the winner of the time trial. So could have been a slightly embarrassing victory from the sort of the UCI IOC point of view, but Kristin Armstrong is the undisputed Olympic champion in the time trial, three in a row.
And
now,
one wonders whether Fabian Cancellara might not have emulated that. He won in Beijing, of course, and in London looked incredibly strong in the road race before he crashed, and that really knocked him out of contention in the time trial. I think, from memory, did he start the time trial? But he was very badly knocked up and not in contention. Bradley Wiggins, of course, won that, and he was in terrific form. It would have probably been close between him and Cancellara, but Cancellara, now, a few people expressing surprise. I think it was a surprise that Cancellara won today and won by so much, but you know, if you look at his season, he started it in tremendous form and looked like he was going to dominate the classics until a crash ruined his classic season. He then went to the Giro, fell ill on the eve of the Giro, and didn't ride particularly well there, and rode okay through the Tour without showing anything particularly spectacular. But the ride that he did today, and he really dominated the time trial, is not a surprise in the context of this being Fabian Cancellara.
Well, I think it's a surprise in the context of the time trials that he's ridden this season. I mean, he has looked like, dare we, to use a phrase that we have employed to not particularly favourable effect before, he did look like a fading force. Certainly when he finished 23rd in the long time trial at the Tour, an absolute abyss away from Tom Dumoulin, who won that time trial. But yeah, he's also thrown in the odd very, very good time trial this year. I mean, you said that he didn't ride particularly well in the Giro. That is true, but he did finish fourth in the long, very difficult, hilly time trial in Chianti there. He won time trial in Tirreno. So yeah, there have been moments. And I mean, today it was a real collection of the sort of battered, bruised and beleaguered from the Tour de France, wasn't it? You know, Tom Dumoulin had his bad crash in the Tour de France, looked as though he wasn't going to compete in Rio for a long time, so he wasn't at his best. Tony Martin was obviously suffering. He had his knee problems on the last day of the Tour de France, bizarrely pulled out on the final stage of the Tour. He obviously, well, he's not ridden particularly well in time trials all year, but he performed very poorly today by his standards. And Froome, you know, did the time trial today come too late after the Tour? It was 2 weeks after the Tour. Had he, you know, sort of fallen off his form peak and has he started to kind of deteriorate after the Tour? So the field was probably slightly weakened, and it didn't really, it didn't favour Cancellara on paper, but I think he rode a very smart Tour de France as far as preparing for Rio was concerned. He didn't go too deep at any point, I don't think.
He also rode a very smart time trial. If you think of where he was on the splits, you know, he was pressing home his advantage at the points where he would be strongest on the course. And a lot was made in advance that it was going to be a very hard time trial, lots of climbing, and we did see riders out of the saddle on the climbs. The climbs were difficult, but in 54 kilometres, an awful lot of that course was rouleur territory. And so, you know, Cancellara, you know, once he gets up to speed, you know, he is exactly that kind of rouleur, isn't he? And those climbs, they're not exactly the sort of climbs that would trouble a rider. It's not like they're mountains, they're just tough in the context of a
time trial. His form at the start of the year suggested that he worked very hard over the winter and the foundation was there, and you know, he just needed the things to go right on the day and have a good preparation. And as for Froome, I mean, the last Olympic Games were, the time trial was 10 days after the end of the Tour. This one was an extra week, and I think that can make all the difference. But I would also wonder why Froome took part in a few post-tour criteriums, which he does tend to do. But I think he rode two, possibly three, certainly two post-tour crits. Now, they don't take a lot out of you, but they do involve travelling, and they involve not resting and recovering properly from the tour. And I just wonder at the wisdom of you know, taking part in those. I know they're very lucrative, but really...
They involve large
yeah,
envelopes.
Yeah, but does Olympic gold...
Greg Van Avermaet also did those criteriums, though, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, so, but he didn't ride the same... He didn't win the tour, did he? So he perhaps didn't come out of the tour in the same shape as Froome. So I just question that. I think it's a curious one, because an Olympic gold medal is surely worth more in the long run.
Also, the first time that Ride London has been described as a criterium.
I didn't mean Ride London.
Oh, right, of course, sorry.
Also, I think today maybe highlighted the fact that a lot has been made of Tom Dumoulin being the successor to Martin and or Cancellara, and I think he is to a large extent, but, and, you know, Rowan Dennis was another one that looked as though he was going to take on that mantle, but perhaps the next generation of very fine time trialists has not quite emerged to the extent that we expected yet. To see Cancellara still beating guys like Dennis and Dumoulin, and not an awful lot in terms of young riders behind them, maybe bears out that point.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
So, as you mentioned at the start, Lionel, I was off to the Tour of Utah, the Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah, I should call it. Thank you very much to Rafa for inviting me out to that, and thanks very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Very grateful for their backing, and it was a fascinating trip. It's one of really the only two major stage races left in America now, and you mentioned in your news roundup that Tour of California will be World Tour next year. That could have really serious implications for the US domestic scene, and for a lot of the teams that that survive there, including the team that won the race with Lachlan Morton, Jelly Belly, not even a pro continental team, but a continental team. So they will not, you know, they will not get a ride at the Tour of California next year, and other teams are in the same boat. So it's troubled times really for US racing, and it was fascinating to go to the Tour of Utah and sample what the racing there is all about. It's really, anyone's watched racing in the US on television, you're almost struck by the, you know, the big wide roads, the big open landscape, and that can be a problem, I think, with the sort of the image of the sport, because I was just, you know, I think of bike racing being most exciting when the race sort of fills the picture, as it were, and it can seem almost that the race and the riders are overwhelmed by the landscape there in a way that perhaps doesn't conjure up the same magic as when we watch racing in Europe.
Interesting point, Rich. I think the width of the roads is the main factor there. When you've got 14 riders on the front row, and when the pace is on, as opposed to sort of two or three, there's just something about the width of the road enables the, you know, it's easier to get from the back to the front, and it doesn't quite look as epic, and the bunch isn't as big either, is it? There's not 200 riders. It's you know,
funny
90 or so.
But I compare it also to the Tour de France when it's in Paris, and it's kind of, it looks very small, you know, in that big, on those big roads around the Place de la Concorde up the Champs Elysees, that the race looks very small in a way that I don't think does it many favours. Anyway, shall we hear my Tour of Utah report?
I was just going to say on that, Rich, that's also probably a reason, well, it may be a reason why we shouldn't rush to hype up riders like Adrian Costa. Did you just pronounce his name Adrian Costa or Adrian Costa? Who everyone got very, very excited about at the Tour of Utah, rightly so, because he's 18 years old and finished second overall, and he's obviously a huge talent. But it reminds me to a large extent of Joe Dombrowski, who is now doing very well in Europe, and certainly the last few months has been riding very well in Europe. But I remember speaking to people at Sky after his first couple of seasons there, which didn't go too well, and they made precisely that point, that the racing is so, so different because of that factor, the size of the roads.
He's made that point himself, that he struggles. I mean, on Costa, he did win the Tour de Bretagne this year as well, so he's won in in Europe as well. He lives in Nice, and he has French parents. Did you know that?
Yes, they're from Fontainebleau, aren't they? South of Paris.
That's correct. That's correct. I spoke to Costa. We'll hear that interview in a future cycling podcast. And I know they certainly call him Adrian, but he seems to pronounce his surname Costa. Although he is riding as a stagiaire for Etics Quickstep at the end of this year, and he pronounced that Etics. He kept calling them Etics, which is unusual. Anyway, let's go to Utah, shall we, and hear my report from the Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah.
Press play.
I'm standing at the summit of Snowbird Mountain on the penultimate day of the Tour of Utah. This has been the queen stage today. Up some pretty major mountains in spectacular landscape. Andrew Talansky has got away with Darwin Atapuma, the two sort of big World Tour teams here, BMC and Cannondale, really stamped their authority on the race today. Lachlan Morton, who rides for Jelly Belly, has been in the yellow jersey for several days, and his team's ridden outstandingly well, but it looks today as though he may be slipping out of the yellow jersey. Tremendous crowds here, very excitable commentators, huge enthusiasm for the race, and we're just waiting at the line now for these two to come through to the finish. Well, Lachlan Morton wasn't hanging about. He disappeared. He sprinted away from the finish area very quickly to head down to his team bus. Try and catch up with him tomorrow on the final day. He seemed very disappointed. I think he really thought he could win this race. Another rider very disappointed in front of me is Tail Gegen Hart, who just slammed a bottle to the ground. Doesn't look very happy. I've been speaking to a few people this week about this race and about the American scene, which has some great teams and riders, but a real dearth of top races, and they're disappearing all the time. The Colorado US Pro Challenge disappeared this year, and this and the Tour of California, Tour of Utah, Tour of California, are really the only two major stage races left on the calendar. So where are we at? I spoke this morning with Phil Guymon and Joe Dombrowski from Cannondale. Started by asking Phil Guymon a little bit about his own podcast, which is very good and highly recommended. And we got talking a bit about the state of health of US cycling.
It's nice, man. It's a fun race. We get cookie deliveries every day. We got Joe and Andrew ripping around. It's gonna be fun.
I mean, you've raced a lot in the US domestically. What's your assessment of the health of the sport here?
I mean, there's always a bunch of good dudes. Like, the riders are good. There's just fewer, smaller teams, and it seems like it's, you know, like, guys aren't getting paid what they were back in the day, but you can't tell by how fast they're ripping us on the climbs.
Is that your assessment too, Joe?
Yeah, the competition level is actually pretty high, you know? You'd think, I do grand tours, I race the biggest races in the world, and you'd come to smaller races in the States and be a piece of cake, but actually, some of these guys are really good.
Well, a lot of people have said that the sound of the riders and the teams is good, but I guess the thing that's lacking is the races.
Yeah, that's true, too. There's fewer and fewer races, especially if you're a Continental team. It's tough because your sponsorship depends on getting invited to something where you're on TV, and then you're just a third of the opportunities every year. So it's definitely a struggle there.
What would you do, you know, if you were in a position to do something to boost the scene here? What would it be?
3-week tour of the United States of America, full-on grand tour, $10 million to the winner. Billion. Make it billion. That's what I would do if I was
in charge. Donald Trump would do.
In charge of this?
I don't know. I plead the fifth on that.
What would you do, Joe? That doesn't sound like a bad idea. 3-week grand tour in the U.S. The country's big enough for it.
Yeah, I think so. I want a bike race in Virginia too, my home state.
So that was Phil Guymon and Joe Dombrowski at the start of the penultimate stage, the Queen stage, and at the summit at Snowbird at the end of that stage, after they had worked really well to put Andrew Talansky in the yellow jersey, I caught up again with Joe Dombrowski. Joe, went according to plan today?
Yeah, pretty much. The only real curveball was the wind. Normally, up this canyon, it's always a tailwind, which tactically makes it really easy because you just ride, and you know, there's not really much advantage to being on the wheel because you have tailwind. Whereas today it was like a ripping headwind, especially at the bottom. So I was a little concerned because we had three or four of us down at the bottom and we were going to ride. But the thing is, it's like you do 150 watts less sitting on when it's 40K an hour wind in your face. So I was a little concerned that we were going to kind of blow ourselves. And then, you know, it starts turning into guys jumping around, and then it's a bit more of a lottery. But it worked out okay. I mean, Andrew took the jersey and has some time, so.
Were you, Lachlan Martin seemed pretty disappointed at the finish. He clearly thought he could hold on. I suppose, though, what we saw there was the big teams really asserting themselves. I mean, were you genuinely worried that he's looked so good all week? Were you worried that, you know, you might not be able to overhaul him?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Lachlan's hugely talented. You know, he's really strong rider, and I think, you know, he has the ability to climb with the best guys, so for sure we're worried about that. But also, I think there's, you know, as you get deeper into these races, this one, I mean, it's only a week, but there's a certain depth, I think, too, to racing in the World Tour that, you know, it's not necessarily faster, but it doesn't really slow down either, and we race longer, and so I think it's a little bit different dynamic.
And what about you? You were disappointed a few days ago. Do you feel you're riding into better form?
Yeah, I think so. I was pretty good today. I mean, when Atapuma attacked, you know, I had sort of
You like being with Atapuma, don't you?
Yeah, my favorite rider in the bunch. when he attacked, you know, I'd been in the wind for a while, and I wasn't going to be able to follow that, so that was basically job done. But you know, I'm feeling good, and hopefully
you're all set for the Vuelta, but more importantly, before that, Leadville.
Exactly. Gonna be ready to win Leadville next weekend.
How have you managed to get permission from your team to ride Leadville?
Do you know, the thing is, I was actually the one that wasn't sure about doing it, whereas the team, JV and Cannondale, are pushing for it. They love it.
Well, good luck in that, and good luck at the Vuelta.
Thanks.
This has been a race where quite a few really good young Americans have shown themselves. I mentioned Adrian Costa already. Another one is Taylor TJ Eisenhart, who is stagiairing for BMC. This is his first week with the Swiss team. And he was very prominent on this stage today, this penultimate stage. A good climber, strong all-rounder. He's from the area too. He's a Utah, Salt Lake City resident, or just the outskirts of Salt Lake City. And at the start, I spoke to Eisenhart.
Yeah, yesterday was a good day, but every day has been a good day. Every day we've put guys in the break, or we've at the end we've put guys on the attack, and so we've really raced an offensive race, you know, and really shown that we are one of the strongest teams here, if not the strongest. And, you know, we're here for the win. We're not settling for third or fourth or fifth. And if that means we have to take two guys out of the top 10 to get a guy on the first step, we'll do that immediately. So we're here for the win.
I mean, being in one of the big teams, as you say, with lots of good guys up there,
yeah.
Does that put a bit of pressure on? Is it something that you enjoy, you know, being able to play different hands? You know,
yeah.
Other teams must be looking at you as well.
Yeah, no, it's definitely one of the biggest teams in the world. But it's also my family. I mean, I've been born and raised on this team, really, since I was 18 years old. And so coming up to it, you don't feel any pressure. You don't feel any, you know, distraction or anything like that. You immediately come up, and just like in this race, you know, I've come up and I'm ready to race. You know, the team has made sure that I'm ready to race. They didn't put me up last year. They didn't put me up the year before. They've really watched me and have been careful. And as you can see, they put me up at the right time where they can see that I'm ready to race and ready to come up to the big leagues.
Tell me about this area, because obviously this is your backyard.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you began cycling here. We all know Colorado as being the sort of center of cycling in the U.S., but is this a sort of little undiscovered gem here?
Yeah, I would say it is a little undiscovered. It's definitely growing quite immensely here. But when I started, I was, you know, 12 years old, and I was one of the only juniors racing in the state of Utah. And actually, where we started the race yesterday, that was, I think, one of my first times racing out there when I was a junior. Was, you know, I remember going out to that race and having to block out my gears because I didn't have junior gears yet. So, you know, it's quite special being here and quite special racing in your backyard. And it really is one of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, you have all my teammates from all around the world who come here and they train, and they have a hard time, you know, kind of going back home because it is so beautiful and the training is so great.
How important is the Tour of Utah, not just for this area, but for U.S. cycling?
The race.
Yeah,
I think, you know, with Colorado being gone now, and now with the news that California is going only pro tour, I think this is absolutely crucial, because the thing is, you still get these continental teams and these pro continental teams who are coming out here, and people underestimate them, but yet they've come out with 3 stage wins so far, and so, like, you know, or no, 4 stage wins. So, you know, people come out here and think, oh, BMC, Trek, Cannondale, IM, you know, they're going to destroy the race. But you look at these guys, they come here, this is their biggest goal of the year, you know, and so they come here ready to race, and they've proven that. They've proven that with the stage wins. So it definitely is crucial for USA Cycling to still have this race to, you know, show these smaller teams and these development in these riders.
So that was one of the local heroes, TJ Eisenhart, rode very strongly again today, and he's riding for BMC. But what of the domestic-based riders? One of them, Angus Morton, or Gus Morton, is an Australian, but he rides for the American Jelly Belly team alongside his brother Lachlan, who, until today, has been leading the race. A few days ago, I spoke to Gus about his brother and about the US scene. For those of you who don't know, and we talk a little bit about this, but Gus and his brother have also made 2 excellent films, Thereabouts and Thereabouts 2. First one follows their journey by bike through the middle of Australia, 2,500 kilometres, I think it was. And it was the first time in a few years that Gus, who at one point had been a very promising rider, had touched his bike. The second film is a journey that they took in Colorado with Taylor Finney, who was at the time recovering from his very serious leg injury. So both those films are really worth watching if you haven't seen them. And I must thank Tom Wally, our producer at the Cycling Podcast, or one of our producers, who pointed me in the direction of them. Excellent if you haven't seen them. But here is Gus Morton. How are you enjoying sort of being back? It's been a while now, but the second film that you did, sort of you were back without really covering your own journey back into the you know, the professional ranks. How are you enjoying it? Do you have a completely different attitude this time around?
Yeah, I'm loving it. It's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, having a ball and you know, my attitude's changed. Like, I've grown up a lot mentally in that time, and kind of, yeah, my attitude towards life is sort of changed and grown. And so, yeah, it's like, for me, this is what I want to do for as long as I possibly can.
There's a lot of talk about the American scene. They've obviously lost a couple of races. How, and you're out for a domestic team. How do you feel, you know, the health of American professional cycling is?
Well, I think athletes-wise, it's the best. You know, it's probably one of the best breeding grounds. And the races that there are amazing, you know, and really competitive and at a super high level. As you can see, you know, this week until today, domestic teams had won every single day. And, you know, like, without sweating it. So, you know, that tells you that the athletes are there. It's just a real shame that the races are disappearing. And, you know, I think that America... You know, as with Australia, as with a lot of the, you know, the Western countries that are non-European countries, have the opportunity to be the best in the world, and that's where cycling's really growing. So, I guess, you know, like, I can't really comment because I'm not a race organizer or anything like that, but I can understand it's probably pretty difficult to run races and that. So maybe that's got something to do with it, but it's devastating, really, to see each race disappear.
Just finally, any plans for a third film?
Not like, I guess, you know, tentatively yes, but nothing concrete, you know, like, we've spoken about it, but it's something that we do when we feel like doing it, and, you know, it takes a lot of work, you know, it's a lot of work for me and to make a film, and
you know, almost need to be at some kind of crossroads or, you know, something for it to happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not like you got to have a story to tell, to be honest, you know, like, obviously, and you know, like, the first one we made, I never really wanted to make that film. Like, I don't really want to talk about myself and tell my own story. Like, it's not something I'm interested in. And so, but we ended up making it because we had people that, friends, it was sort of like, you need to make it. So we made it. So, yeah, once you find another story to tell about someone else or something else, then we'll go and do it.
Somebody.
Yeah, well, I'm not looking. No, like I'm waiting for something to find me. I think that's the best way to do it. You know, if you search for stuff, you're just making yourself do it. Whereas I think if you wait, then something that really is genuine to you will appear, and it'll make you want to do it.
This race has been, it's been one of the best supported races and the best run races I've ever been to. I've been at a few races.
This is James McCallum, former rider, now sports director at One Pro Cycling, the Pro Conti team, who have raced mainly in Europe this year.
But just the way everything's been really smooth, and the organisation has been, you know, it's been great. Everything, like the foods, the hotels, everything's been, you know, it's been top notch. But even the racing, you know, the racing's been proper racing, and it's not been the big teams dominating, which you would expect, like your World Tour teams. It's been all like the,
well, today's the first day that, yeah, that a World Tour team has won a stage.
Yeah, and I think that's great to see for the future of the sport in America, teams like Colawesco and Axion, you know, doing the business.
You know, what do you feel about, I mean, so is your impression that these guys are the equal of, you know, most of the teams that you come up against at Pro Conti level in Europe?
It's tough to say because the style of racing is so different. I mean, the race here is on big, wide open roads, and it's, from what I hear, it's pretty easy in the bunch to get from the back to the front, whereas you'll have known, having raced in Europe, Richard, that you know, it's not that easy back by us. You know, like if you're racing in Spain or if you're racing in Belgium, it's always a, you know, it's a massive, massive fight to get to the front, and that's part and parcel of that kind of apprenticeship of being a pro rider, isn't it?
It's really interesting that, I mean, quite a lot of American riders who've come through the American system have really struggled with that. Joe Dombrowski is a classic example.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, I mean, I've seen it when a few American guys came to the UK, even just to ride the criteriums, they struggled because it was just so much more technical and smaller and more confined, and there's not as much room to, you know, manoeuvre. But that's just part of being a bike rider. You've got to be good at all kinds of styles of racing, haven't you? Whether it's, you know, hilly parkours or, you know, flat windy ones, it's also the width of the road and thinking your positioning is really, really paramount, you know?
After he sprinted away from the finish at Snowbird, a little bit disappointed to have lost the yellow jersey, I tracked down Lachlan Morton at the start of the final stage in Park City. He was down to the second overall, 22 seconds behind Talansky. Morton is a fascinating character, a huge talent. He turned professional with Garmin when he was just 20, but the life didn't seem to really agree with him, the life of a pro in Europe. And after a couple of years, he quit and has been racing in the US ever since. It's something that's explored in the first Thereabouts film, which I mentioned earlier. But in Park City, on the morning of that final stage, I spoke to Lachlan Morton. Here he is. Disappointed yesterday to lose the jersey.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the guys ride all day, it's a shame not to be able to pull it off for them. But, you know, I kind of rode slightly conservatively because I knew when they attacked that if I tried to follow, there's a chance, you know, you blow up totally. So, you know, we lost some time, but it's nothing that, you know, isn't still to play for today. So
you're still optimistic today's another hard day, you know, might turn around again today.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like 40 or 45 minutes of really, really hard climbing. It's the hardest climb of the race. So, you know, although it's a bigger job, you know, you're going to have to get away and then stay away on the downhill. It's going to have to be a big ride, but, you know, we're going to try.
You've got that, and your team's been outstanding this week.
Yeah, the team's been incredible. I think everyone's been surprised. You know, they've all ridden their asses off, like, every day. And, you know, I want to do it for them more than anyone.
I mean, you've shown that you're, you know, equal to most of the World Tour riders, if not all of them here. And obviously, you're still young. The question people ask is, will you return to World Tour level at any time? Is that something you would like to do?
Yeah, I mean, I'd still like to do the big races, you know. Like, I see the tour on the TV and wish I was there, you know. I think I've still got some unfinished business there. But, you know, it'd have to be the right circumstance for me, you know. I've sort of realised, you know, now that that's not everything, you know. Like, it's not worth giving up everything else just so you can go and race, you know, the Tour de France. So
has there been any interest? Have you been aware of any interest?
No.
So it's not likely next year, but something that you wouldn't rule out in the next sort of couple of years?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I'd have to get an offer first. That's the first step, you know. But, yeah, I'm not too fussed about it, to be honest.
Great. Good luck today. Thanks, Michael. I'm standing now at the finish in Park City. But this morning, before the stage, I spoke to Chris Jones, the United Healthcare rider, to present him with the coveted Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. I'd asked Alex Howes, a Cannondale rider and a Tour de France Pedaleur de Charme, for nominations, and he didn't hesitate. Chris Jones, he said, was not only a stylish pedaler, but also a stalwart of the US scene and a nice guy to boot. Just as we were speaking, in fact, Jones pedaled past very charmingly and wearing a nice cotton peaked cap. So he seemed like a popular choice as winner of our Pedaleur de Charme for the Tour of Utah. Here is Chris Jones. Chris, congratulations, our Pedaleur de Charme for the Tour of Utah.
Thank you, man. I'm really excited. Honored, I would say.
All to Alex Howes.
Hey, yeah, really? I don't know. I don't trust that guy. I mean, he's probably got something up his sleeve. He's probably going to try and trick me into working or something for him today. But honored, free t-shirt. I love it.
How's the race been for you?
You know, it's kind of been a mixed bag. We came here with four really good climbers, and they've all had their off days. They've had really good days and then just one bad day. So we're really close on King of the Mountains. We've got second place. We're like 2 points off. So fingers crossed that we pull that home today.
How big a race is this for the US-based riders? You know, obviously one or two races have gone. So, you know, what does this mean as a sort of shop window, a showcase for you guys?
Yeah, there. You know, we used to have Tour of California, Utah, and Colorado. We lost Colorado this year, unfortunately. California for United Healthcare is always going to be our biggest race because United Healthcare is based in California. But Utah is a close second. And I would say as a rider, Utah it ranks up there as one of my favorites. I mean, the terrain is incredible, and the fans are just encouraging here. We love coming out here early, too, for a couple weeks to acclimate. So I hope this race sticks around as long as I do.
I mean, I was saying to somebody the other day, everybody knows about Colorado as a great outdoors capital. Utah's not so well known.
Yeah, it's a little odd to me. I mean, we come up here to Park City, you know, and spend a lot of July up here. And I love it. It's great for families, great mountain biking, great road riding. I'd love to come back here in the winter someday, maybe when I retire. But yeah, it's weird that it's not as well known as Colorado. And I hope that the race, you know, brings some publicity to it, because I'd like to see the race keep going and like to see more people visit Park City.
As we heard earlier from Lachlan Morton, the race wasn't over as far as he was concerned. And the final stage of the Tour of Utah proved to be an absolute thriller. There was rain, there were mountains, more great names, there was Wolf Creek Ranch, and finally Empire Pass, and lots of attacking. There was chaos. At one point, Andrew Talansky was isolated, and Lachlan Morton was left behind. But the sound you hear there is the crowd welcoming Lachlan Morton, who has arrived alone as the winner of the stage, and the winner, probably, of the Tour of Utah. We just have to wait for Talansky now. Morton was dropped earlier, but he was saving it all for that final climb of Empire Pass. He attacked right at the bottom. It's a savage climb, 12 kilometers long, average gradient of 8%. Talansky started to struggle. He dropped back. He was being paced all the way up by Joe Dombrowski. But behind Morton, it was the remarkable Adrian Costa, who has just crossed the line now. 18 years old. He turns 19 very soon. Rides for Axel Merckx's action team. He's smiling there. He will finish second overall, I'm pretty sure. A really remarkable final day's racing. And these two teams, Jelly Belly and Action, an under-23 development team, have really shown the World Tour teams how it's done. Really incredible turnaround on this final day. Fantastic day's racing, fantastic race, and a worthy winner in Lachlan Morton. He said earlier that no World Tour teams have been in touch with him, but they surely will now. If not tonight, then tomorrow. Lachlan, you said this morning it wasn't over. You were right.
Yeah, I knew I still had something in the tank, and I left it all out there then.
And when you went at the bottom of the climb, were you surprised
they couldn't follow you? Let's go. I mean, it had been a really hard race.
Right here, left.
My team were incredible all day. I just wanted to wait and go one time. And it paid to be patient and to wait and to do it that way.
Well, there we have it. The 2016 Tour of Utah won by Lachlan Morton. Of Jelly Belly with Adrian Costa second. Now, I haven't spoken about Costa as much as I perhaps should have done. I have all week been speaking to to him and his team, including Teo Gegenhart and Axel Merckx, who's in charge of the team, also young Eddie Dunbar from Ireland, for a special report on the Action team. Remarkable program that Axel Merckx has developed over the last few years. I also spoke this morning to Ben King, who rides for Cannondale and was the first rider ever signed to that program back in 2009, I think. So it's a conveyor belt that's produced yet another great talent, it seems, in Adrian Costa, who is riding for Etix Quickstep at the end of this year as a stagiaire. But he will remain with Action next year and perhaps beyond, because he is still only 18, turns 19 very soon. But a huge prospect, clearly.
Ladies and gentlemen, your 2016 champion, Lachlan Morton! All right, we will now move to our top three riders on the stage here on the final day, Stage 7, presented by the Utah Sports Commission. Let's get right to it with the top step of the podium. This man needs no introduction. Welcome back, Lachlan Morton! Lachlan's being presented his flowers by Ogden Mayor, Mr. Mike Caldwell.
I do love the understated PA at the Tour of Utah.
There they are, ladies and gentlemen, your top three overall at the 2016 Tour of Utah. Lachlan Morton, Adrian Costa, and Andrew Talansky.
I think his voice might be starting to go.
And now it's time for the champagne celebration for our top three riders overall.
Now, will Costa be allowed a bottle of champagne? Yes, he's been handed a bottle of champagne. But they'll be keeping an eye on him to make sure. Oh no, they've taken it back. The announcer's taken it back. He was given a bottle of champagne and the announcer came and took it back with a, wagged his finger. It's being sprayed. I hope none of that ends up in Costa's mouth. He could be in trouble.
Ladies and gentlemen, one more time for Lachlan Morton, Adrian Costa, and Andrew Wingarms-Talansky.
All very jolly on the podium. Talansky couldn't get the cork off his bottle. That's maybe a measure of how tired he is. But Lachlan Morton did the job for him. Remember, Morton's team, Jelly Belly, isn't a Pro Conti team. It's a Continental team. But nice scenes on the podium. As Talansky and Morton drain their bottles of champagne, and poor old Costa has to go thirsty. Well, it's all gone very quiet now, and they're just clearing things away here at the Tour of Utah. Cracking final day, cracking race, worthy winner in Lachlan Morton. A really great final day though, and it was short. It was about 125 kilometres, mountainous, and produced really thrilling racing. One of the riders there said that there wasn't even time for a pee stop. It was action from the gun. And I'd like to say thank you very much to Rafa for inviting me out to this race and for sponsoring the cycling podcast, of course. Thank you to them. Thanks to the Tour of Utah. Maybe we'll be back next year.
The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa.
Very good stuff, Rich. It sounds like you enjoyed yourself.
I really did enjoy myself, and it's great, you know, meeting new riders, new teams. Lachlan Morton is obviously a great talent and a great story, and Costa, who we spoke about a little bit before we heard that, is certainly a great talent and only 18 years old, and a lot of comparisons with Greg LeMond. He's also got the blonde hair, very personable chap, and I mentioned there in that package that I've done, I interviewed all the Action riders, Axel Merckx's team, including Merckx himself, and Teo Gegenhart, friend of the podcast, Teo Gegenhart, who will join, who I know what team he's joining now next year, but I'll not say it because that would be unfair. But I think we can probably guess. Anyway, it was a fascinating trip, well worth making, and you know, it'll be interesting to see how some of those guys do. It would be fantastic to see Lachlan Morton have another chance in Europe, and and interesting to watch the progress not only of Costa but some of his young teammates as well. Eddie Dunbar is another one who rode a good race, so that was fun. Shall we wrap things up? We need to come back next week, and I suppose we'll be talking about track cycling next week, won't we?
We certainly will. The real Olympics starts on Thursday with the track.
Can I send that one out?
I think it would be fun if you watch the track cycling and then... Yeah, you've got Mark Cavendish going in the Omnium. Surely you've got a passing interest in that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I'll be watching this weekend. Pursuit as well, you know. I know some of those riders. Anyway.
You know it's a team pursuit. Yeah, the pursuit isn't in the Olympics anymore.
Yeah, I know that one. I know that.
Anyway, like that one. Okay, excellent.
Daniel, the American women's team pursuit have got their bikes have got the cranks on the wrong side.
They're on the
left side.
No, so not the cranks, Lionel. They've got cranks on both sides.
Well, they've got cranks on both sides. Sorry, the drivetrain on the left hand side with the chain and the sprocket. When you see that, Daniel, don't sort of turn your television round or assume that there's some kind of problem with the picture. That's how it's supposed to be.
And what's the logic?
The logic is they've done some testing in the wind tunnel, and they've worked out, or they believe that the evidence shows that it's more aerodynamic, because obviously the bike turns left, doesn't it, all the way around the track, and it makes the airflow smoother on the outside.
Left-handers are at a bit of a disadvantage on the track, aren't they?
Really? Why?
Because for a right-hander, it's easier to turn left.
Is that right?
I think we've had this debate before, Richard. I'm convinced of this. But anyway, let's get... Surely a listener will be able to settle this.
Yeah, if there's any scienticians out there that know about left-handedness and turning right...
Scientician?
Yeah.
There we go. Anyway.
Excellent. Right, okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us this week. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Charles.